tell me it gets better in time. You say I pull myself together, pull it together, you'll be fine. Tell me what the hell do you know?
You're listening to WPRK 91.5 FM, the best in basement radio and the voice of Rollins College. Welcome to Freudian Quips, a show dedicated to promoting mental health awareness through the examination of popular culture and global current events. I'm your co-host, Dr. Derek Palladino.
And I'm Dr. Samuel Sanabria. And the song that we just heard is a song written and sung by Lady Gaga. And it's called Till It Happens to You, which is the title song to a 2015 documentary called The Hunting Ground, which is a documentary that focuses on two students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill who reported sexual assault to their campus Title IX, and it apparently had some trouble with the investigation, and the administration of the campus was very lax in that, and it had national attention, and it's been very problematic for the university and for many women across college campuses. And today we have two very special guests with us, and today we're going to talk about sexual assault and harassment. Derek, can you please introduce our speakers?
Yeah, absolutely. We're excited to have our Title IX office from Rollins College here, and that includes Oriana Jimenez, who's the director of the office, and Manny Ayala, who is the program specialist at the Title IX office. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
We're excited to have you today, and I do want to tell the listeners, this is our third try at this, because the first two didn't tape, and I feel so sad that we did had some great conversations and it didn't tape, but I wouldn't want to spend this time three times with anyone else other than the Title IX office.
Thank you. Exactly.
And you're both so gracious for coming back and giving us another chance here. So thank you.
Well, it's an important message, and so we're grateful for the opportunity. Yeah. Thank you.
Awesome.
And we're in April right now, which is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So we're going to talk about that and the programming that Rollins College is doing near the end of today's episode. So stay tuned for that. And why don't we kind of just jump in here, and if both of you can kind of introduce yourselves, your journey to the Title IX office, and then we can kind of go into what is Title IX and what is the Rollins College Title IX office?
Sure, sure. So my name's Oriana Jimenez. I'm the director of the Office of Title IX, and I've been at Rollins College for almost 11 years professionally. I came up through human resources and did a lot of work with employee relations and leadership and organizational development work in that field. And as it relates to employee relations, that's really more of like conflict management in the workplace and a lot of issues as it relates to, I guess, employee conduct. And then about 2 years ago, then I jumped over to the student affairs side of the college, working much more closely with student conduct and in particular issues of Title IX, which is encompasses everything related to sex-based discrimination, gender-based discrimination, and sexual misconduct on campus.
And Manny Ayala here. I guess I'm a program specialist here at Title IX, so I help with the programming side of things, Stalking Awareness Months, Bystander Intervention Months, and before being at Title IX and at Rollins, I was working for a local domestic abuse center, and I was leading up a lot of the programming for anti-bullying initiatives, teen dating abuse, intimate partner violence, and putting those forth with Orange County Public Schools. So,
Great. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
And why don't you, if you can, talk a bit about what the Title IX office is, and then I think we can kind of go into what is Title IX.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah? So the Office of Title IX is a resource office on campus whose purpose is really to support students, faculty, and staff who might be experiencing some type of sexual trauma, abuse, harassment, assault, any number of different types of instances of sexual misconduct that could occur either on or off campus to individuals. My office is able to receive those reports from either the individuals themselves who are experiencing these issues, or from third parties who are hoping to, you know, be a support person for somebody else. And then what we do is we offer support services and care, student care to those individuals, which could look any number of different ways. Some individuals want to file a formal report with law enforcement, and in some of these cases of sexual misconduct, some of these behaviors do constitute crimes under the law. So in those cases, if they wish to exercise their civil rights to file the law enforcement report, I help them do that. Otherwise, if they don't want to do that, that's okay too. They don't have to. There's nothing that says that they are required to go to law enforcement to file a report. They could just file a report that stays entirely within the institution. They may or may not request that the institution conduct an investigation. That's also their choice in most cases. They may just want something like a no contact order or a change in their housing, on-campus housing situation, academic accommodation, so assistance with getting some support from their faculty, connections to mental health counseling, connection to medical treatment, any number of different services that I can provide to these students if they wish to take advantage of them, I do. The other thing that we can do is we can issue no contact orders. So in some cases, a student will come forward and they're experiencing a situation with another individual on campus, and simply all that they want at that point in time is they just want it to stop. They just want that behavior to stop, and the issuance of a no contact order, which is a directive from a college official stating that these two people are no longer to have contact, is sufficient. In and of itself, that's a non-disciplinary measure, mm-hmm. But the disciplinary or conduct actions can come into place if either party violates the order after it's been issued. Yeah. So there's a few different things that we can do and that we do in our office to support students who come forward.
It's a very important organization or service that you do provide, and you mentioned two options. One is for support, that mm-hmm. if somebody comes in and they have experienced sexual trauma, they can seek services. But mm-hmm. it's not your office that provides the services. Do you connect them to different organizations, for example, or institutions like CAPS on campus, the counseling yes. center? Do you connect them there and help them?
I do a lot of mm-hmm. direct referrals to services, okay. Both on and off campus. And whether or not they accept any of the services that I provide directly, I almost always try to get them to refer to some kind of service on campus, some kind of yes. mental health yeah. counseling, if they'll accept doing that. If they're open to it, you know, we talk about it. We also have, because that's available confidentially. And we have also the Dean of Religious Life, Reverend Katrina Jenkins. She's also a confidential resource on campus. If a person wants to go to somebody who's more of a spiritual counselor in that mm-hmm. in that sense, they can receive counseling in that way as well. So they have two options for counseling that are entirely confidential, and they can do that before or after speaking with me. They don't have to speak with me first to be able to get to either one right, of those right. places. They can go directly there, and then in those places, they'll talk to them about their options, including their option to go to the Office of Title IX and to talk with me personally.
I think it's worth noting that, you know, students that come up to directly to Title IX should know that we are mandated reporters, right? So if they do disclose a certain type of issue regarding sexual assault specifically or anything along those lines, we have to report that. So that's why the partnership is so important with mm-hmm. Katrina Jenkins, the Dean of Religious Life, and CAPS and the counselors on campus, because they are confidential resources. So we need to be able to offer the students a little bit of everything to really cater to what they need in the moment, in terms, you know, if you've been sexually assaulted, typically it's a moment of crisis. So we want them not to feel as though the first time that they're talking, if they're not ready to act on that,
right, to report,
that mm-hmm. we're going to now go and report it, and they have to now go through with an investigation and all these things. Like, we want to meet them where they are.
So when you say you're a mandated reporter, mm-hmm. where is the report going to?
To me.
To you.
To me, yes. So most people on campus, the vast majority of people, faculty, staff, are mandated reporters. So what that means is if they learn that there is either confirmed or any possibility of sexual misconduct occurring on campus or that has occurred to a specific person, they're required to report that information to me. It's not a mandate that they report to law enforcement or anything like that. They just need to elevate whatever it is that they know to the Office of Title IX, to the Title IX coordinator, myself. There, and other than that, they're not asked to do an investigation. They're, you know, they don't need to put themselves in the role of trying to confirm whether or not this really happened. I'd actually rather that they not do those things, because if you're not a trained professional, really you should not be stepping outside of any role besides giving support to a person that comes forward and discloses that they've experienced sexual violence or trauma. And we can talk a little bit more later about how do you support somebody who comes forward.
But when it comes to you, when you get this information, this report, what do you do then? Because it's not coming directly from the victim. This is coming from... So what happens then?
When I get a third-party report, typically what I do is I'll work very closely with that person to attempt to make contact. So in many cases, that third person comes forward and... they have already disclosed to the individual that they have to report it or that they're going to report it. And so that individual is expecting some outreach from my office. And then in other cases, that person has no idea that this individual is coming forward and reporting what happened to them as a third party. And so in that case, you know, I need to utilize my relationship with them now to almost kind of triangulate that, right? And try to... allow them to help me to make contact with that person. You know, either they can go back and talk to them and attempt to bring that person with them to come and meet with me or talk with them about meeting with me or do something. But at the end of the day, I don't want to force anybody to come and meet with me and talk with me, because I recognize that there are certain implications related to that. You know, this sense of like formal reporting, even the word reporting and calling it that. It scares people, particularly when they're in a crisis moment. and so if a person is not mentally or emotionally ready to take that step, that's okay.
Yes.
And rather than being in the Office of Title IX, where they really, really need to be, is in one of the confidential resource centers, right? At the Wellness Center, talking to a medical or a mental health professional, with Reverend Katrina Jenkins, the Dean of Religious Life, with Victim Service Center of Central Florida, which is a external community resource that's confidential, or talking with Harbor House of Central Florida, also external resource that's confidential, right? Any of those places, they can help support a survivor in the meantime until they're ready to get to what would be a next step, you know, like an Office of Title IX on their campus, you know, Rollins, if it's someone affiliated with us or with taking a law enforcement step. Those are big steps. You know.
It is. And I like that approach, because to have the experience of sexual assault or harassment, I can imagine how one may feel disempowered. They don't have power.
Absolutely.
And if you were to push the issue and force the person to report it, to come in and do so, you're just perpetuating that.
Right.
You know, you do want to bring the power back to the victim.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Sexual violence is an issue of power and control, and it's one person establishing their power and control over another, and thereby reducing the survivor's power in that situation. So we want to empower people. You know, and it's really not just us as professionals in the work in the field. You know, if you're a friend out there and you know somebody, you want to empower that person to make decisions on their own about what they're going to do going forward. You certainly can and should encourage things like getting medical treatment, getting mental health counseling, seeking help and support. Please do encourage those things. But you don't want to force anything on a survivor.
Yeah, what I was going to say is the report word sort of struck me as you mentioned it. It's not a very, you know, it feels like it's taking the power away, that word. And when someone is a victim of sexual assault, harassment, and they're in that moment without power, I can imagine there's so much confusion. Mm-hmm. They're trying to make sense of what happened. And when you hear the word report, you think action, that now I have to do something about it, instead of why can't I just sort of figure this out and talk with someone or sit by myself and sort of reflect on it a bit before making this next step. So I really like that your phrase of I don't want anyone to feel forced to see me, because it really is their time when they're ready to take that step.
Right, right. And I do have students who come to me and I can recognize that they're not ready. And that's okay. We talk about that. And I let them know that that's okay, and that that their story is their story, and they're the owner of that story, and that they don't have to tell me anything. You know,
yeah.
You don't have to tell me anything in that moment. You're not ready. That's okay. Let me tell you where you can go to talk to somebody confidentially, okay. You know, or if they want to share their story without sharing the name of the person that they feel that is harassing them or assaulted them. They can share the information about what occurred. They can process that with me if they'd like to, right? I'll help them process that, because a lot of these students, they don't necessarily know what it is that happened to them. They don't know what it's called. They're not applying a label to it. I'm really careful about applying a label to what occurred. But they come in just feeling or thinking that whatever happened was wrong, and that they didn't want that to happen, and they're still kind of grappling in their mind with what it was that happened in the first place. Was this an assault? Did they think I consented? Why would they have thought that? You know, these are really big questions in their mind that they're trying to process. So I can help them process, and I will help them process those things if they would like to. But again, if they're not there,
yeah,
you know, who am I to say that they should suddenly get there just because they're physically in the space of my office?
I think as bystanders in situations of sexual harassment or assault or, you know, any type of trauma along those lines, we can a lot of times know the person just in our personal lives. And if they trust us or they see us as a resource, they're going to come to us. And we may know what that is. Right, like we may already have labeled their story in our minds. Oh, you definitely went through domestic violence, or you're definitely being abused, or you were definitely taken advantage of. But empowering is not to impart that information right off the bat. Empowering is to be able to guide them. And I think that's real key, because we go over it over and over, but when someone you care about approaches you and they're in crisis mode, and or they're crying or they're hurting, I think a lot of us want to make sure that person's okay. So our first instinct may be to tell them, like, oh, this is what's happening. Like, you need to do this.
And those are our definitions of those experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
Right,
definitely.
Right. And they're based on our own personal experiences and what we believe and know to be true, which may or may not be accurate in that person's life.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about definitions, okay? Because, not that we are going to impart that on the people who have experienced this sexual trauma, but let's talk a little bit now amongst ourselves of what are those different experiences. Because I think in the past you have mentioned sexual harassment versus sexual assault. Can you share a little bit about what the difference is?
So sexual harassment is actually pretty pervasive on college campuses, and it's typically a course of conduct that is that occurs within a space that makes people feel uncomfortable, right? And it's sexual in nature in terms of the actual conduct itself. So it could be something like telling sexual jokes or even telling jokes about, that denigrate a certain race or gender or sexual orientation, things like that, over time, it might be it might be one joke or one instance that makes people feel uncomfortable, or it might be a situation where it involves something maybe more egregious, more in depth, like touching. You know, that person that every time they come around to check on your work, you know, they brush up against you, or they have to make some kind of physical contact with you that's not necessary. That's kind of outside the scope of what they need to do. And so checking up on your work is just like a pretext to come in and make physical contact with you, to come in and say sexual jokes or sexual innuendo around you and things like that. Just to kind of see how you respond, right? Like that behavior that's always kind of pushing the limits, pushing the boundaries to see what kind of reaction they get. And some people really do think it's funny. The penis on the whiteboard concept, it's funny, why do you have to be such a prude and erase it kind of thing. But things like that do create what we call a hostile environment, particularly in a learning community. Those are behaviors that make people feel like they should be or want to be reluctant to enter those spaces, those classrooms, right? Like, oh, gosh, now I have class with the guy that's always telling dirty jokes, when's he going to stop.
Well, also, something that might be funny to one person can be extremely triggering
to another person. To another person, absolutely. So, so some of that constitutes sexual harassment. Sexual harassment could also be so egregious that it's just one instance or occasion. You know, and a lot of times when we're talking about egregious behaviors, right, like a person exposing themselves, right, that's sexual harassment that's egregious enough to constitute one occasion. You know, one occasion of something like that is absolutely sexual harassment. And then when we get to some of the other behaviors, like, for example, sexual assault that you mentioned, now we're talking about actual sexual touching that is typically of the intimate parts of another person. And then the issue of consent also is a big deal. When we talk about touching another person, you know, there's in a sexual way without consent, right? That's denigrating to that person. That's taking advantage of that person, right? Mm-hmm. And so sexual assault can look a few different ways, right? It can be sexual touching of the intimate body parts of another person without actual like sex or intercourse happening, or penetration, what we call is the terminology that we use in our work. But when we start to talk about sexual contact that includes penetration of any kind of any part of the body, that is rape. That is, we typically refer to that also as sexual assault on college campuses, but that meets the legal definition of rape under the FBI definitions.
Well, and I can imagine how, I mean, just going back to the harassment part and the examples that you gave with the joking and the drawing things on the whiteboard in class. And, mm-hmm. you know, we do have a culture in our society where we joke a lot and, mm-hmm. you know, and it's funny to be sexually inappropriate and you know, people laugh along that. And especially with young people who may not have been exposed outside of their home environment to diverse mm-hmm. groups, where right. you are now negotiating different ways of thinking and being and different experiences. And
absolutely.
Yeah, so I can imagine how you have people who maybe unintentionally really do something that is triggering and inappropriate, mm-hmm. but it's a learning experience for them.
Absolutely.
And they could hopefully move forward and not do it again.
Right. And we do see that a lot, and because there are cultural differences, right? When you have a diverse community, there are cultural differences that apply to a lot of the ways that we interact and behave with one another, including pursuing romantic relationships.
Yeah.
Right. In the pursuit of romantic relationships, in some cultures are much more aggressive than others. And so what I have seen is sexual harassment is really as the result of somebody not understanding that their advances are not welcome.
Right.
That they're, you know, that when a person says, no, I don't want to go on a date with you, you know, after the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, like that starts to become excessive and harassing. A person shouldn't have to reject another individual's advances, you know, 3, 4, 5 times.
You're right.
You know, one time, two times. If that's it, right?
Yeah, you know,
move on.
And I like that you said that there are just cultural differences in because I remember. I mean, I grew up in Miami. I'm a Latin person, and we're very, in my family and in my community where I grew up, we were very affectionate with people. Mm-hmm. And when we greeted people, both men and women, actually, we would mm-hmm. give them hugs and, you know, sometimes we'd give them kisses on the cheeks or whatever. And leaving that and coming to college for the very first time in my life, I worked part time. But I remember being called into HR, you know, as a young person, because mm-hmm. I would walk into my office environment and give people hugs, like, hey, you know, hugs, and sometimes give them kisses. And it was a big learning experience for me. It's like, what?
Yeah.
People,
culture
not
shock.
Everybody is like that. Why we don't do that? No. So there is a big cultural difference. And again, as I mentioned with young people, I can imagine how we really have to educate them, teach them how to
absolutely.
Negotiate these different.
Absolutely. Yeah. And how to navigate those environments, right? Where what's okay at home might not be okay.
Yeah.
In that new environment that they are operating in.
So it sounds like we have the support piece of Title IX office, but then as you're talking, I'm starting to think of sort of your role, Manny, in programming, in that there's education because of maybe some lack of experience and immaturity and the brain still developing for some of our students, right? Also education on one's rights as well. So the office is really doing this tandem sort of support and educating at the same time.
I think some of the things that are obvious to people that are working in the field is that, you know, things like boundaries are obvious, or maybe to you, Sammy, you're growing up in this culture where it's obvious that you give someone a hug, right? Like you see someone and like you're being friendly, and that's not obvious to someone else where you're coming from. And so
personal space is different culturally. Sometimes people, 3 inches is, that's perfectly fine. Others is like 24 inches, get away.
I was like, I don't know you that well. Exactly. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter when you're coming from a culture where hugging is the norm, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think norms are an important thing that we need to discuss. Like, what are the norms in your culture? What are the norms in the space that you're operating in, whether it's academics, whether it's a career? There's always going to be kind of a standard norm. But any place you have a group of people coming from different backgrounds, you're going to have different perceptions and definitions of what is appropriate behavior, what is socially acceptable. And so how do we kind of pick out the patterns that indicate that there is something that truly is inappropriate? Right? And that's when the education piece comes in, because, you know, you may be talking about cultures where a pattern of maybe kind of invasive behavior may be attractive, or may mean like, hey, this person really likes me because they're really trying to get a hold of me. Right? Or maybe jealousy, maybe an indicator of attraction, like, oh, well, he's so jealous. He really cares about me. Right? And that's how it starts, right? Like there are different perceptions. And if we don't sit around the table and have a conversation about what is healthy and what's appropriate behavior,
right?
What are these boundaries and what do they mean for everyone? I mean, you don't have to accept, but you can't impose.
Impose, that's right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So the education piece is so critical, because if we're not having these discussions about what really is a boundary or what's consent, right? Like, what is a pattern of behavior that really is unhealthy in our relationship, then we're not really setting ourselves up to prevent issues of sexual assault, sexual violence, and a lot of other things. I mean, this principle applies to a lot of things, not just sexual assault.
When we look at like dating and domestic violence in particular, right, like those interpersonal violence, right, that doesn't start on the first date,
right?
Abuse typically doesn't start early on in the relationship, although it can start early. And I mean, physical abuse, I should say, or typically doesn't start really early on. How that starts is typically a control, manipulation, right? The 20 questions interrogation: where were you? Who was there? Why'd you go? Why'd you stay so long? How much did you have to drink? And what were you wearing? And all of these things, right? Like, those are typically how these things start, and then they start to escalate with the give me all of your passwords, let me see your phone, take your phone away, you can't leave, right? Now, not allowing a person to just live their free life even to the extent of not allowing them to fulfill their responsibilities at work and school and things like that. And then it starts to escalate over time, right? More and more control starts to become escalate in different ways in terms of its manifestation, until it can very easily become physical abuse over time. And then once that boundary is crossed, you just can't go back from that.
Let's talk about physical abuse, physical assault, and what the education behind that is. I mean, we talked about the harassment and the subtleties, and sometimes not so subtlety.
Yeah.
But with assault, we're looking at something that's a little bit more extreme.
Yes.
And what I hear in regards to debates about sexual assault, and if you saw the documentary The Hunting Ground, there seems to be a debate. It's like, she didn't say no, or he didn't say no. And, you know, we were both drunk. So why is this an issue now? I don't understand. So how do you educate people on what is consensual sex?
Yeah. So the issue of consent is such a critical piece in terms of educating the community, because One part of this is educating, like, what are these prohibited behaviors on our campus and really in society as a whole, right? In college or not in college, nobody should be exploiting people, you know, or sexually assaulting people or abusing people. But when it comes specifically to the issue of consent, you know, and alcohol, it does get blurry, you mm-hmm. know, and to some extent, and particularly because the role of alcohol is really critical in terms of putting people in situations that they find themselves to be at higher risk mm-hmm. of being assaulted. And typically it's people, women and men who engage in these abusive behaviors, who will either utilize alcohol, right, themselves to reduce their inhibitions and to excuse their behavior as abusers or as people who perpetrate assault. Or they will use alcohol to facilitate sexual assault on another person and put a person into a vulnerable position, which is really, really scary. But honestly happens all of the time. Mm. All of the time. It's called alcohol-fueled sexual assault. And it does impact the majority of cases that we see on college campuses, where either one or both parties claim that they were intoxicated, or in some cases a person is claiming that they were intoxicated and they weren't necessarily intoxicated. They were the one providing and fueling the other person to become intoxicated so that they could put them in a vulnerable position and take advantage of and exploit that position. Typically what we say is you know, a good rule of thumb is if you have been drinking to the extent that you can no longer drive, right? You're too drunk to drive, then you're probably too drunk to engage in sexual contact consensually.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And consent, I think it has to go, there's two big points related to consent, right? A person needs to be able to consent. So they're physically able, right, to consent. They're of sound mental standing and physically. They are, you know, not under the influence of drugs or alcohol, or I should say, you know, to that extent that they wouldn't be able to drive. You know, some persons with disabilities, you know, are at high risk. They're not necessarily able to consent. The elderly, children, right? These are high risk groups that are not able to consent for various reasons, right? Whether it's age or, you know, just groups of individuals that are vulnerable anyway, and then that people choose to exploit. You know, if you're too drunk to drive, you're too drunk to consent. And in most cases, if you're too drunk to drive, you're too drunk to seek consent, right? Mm. Because there's the giving of the consent, but there's also the seeking of consent. So if you're too drunk to be able to say to somebody coherently, you know, do you want to engage in whatever act, right? Whatever that ask looks like in a coherent way, then you probably shouldn't be engaging in sexual contact or intimate contact with them.
I hope this message really sinks in with people who are listening to this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always go back to the same idea when it comes to consent, of being that why not ask? I mean, it's half a second. Is it okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Is this okay?
Yeah.
It's not that complicated, but a lot of times, I mean, and from presentations that I've given previously, I've even heard women say, well, you know, I don't want him to ruin the mood, or if you're a man, you're just going to get up and do it.
Which is what people see on TV.
Yeah. We have to remember we're up against a culture of, I don't know if I want to say like hyper masculinity or hypersexuality or,
mm-hmm.
We're
not.
Right. I mean, we're amping up what actual sexual behavior looks like to be this kind of aggressive and all or nothing behavior where if we're already in the same room, then it's going to happen.
It's mm-hmm. romanticized. I see that. Yes. It's so romanticized to just take someone, pick them up, throw them against the wall and, you know, in the heat of passion. It's romanticized. It's glamorized. And people
Absolutely.
Receive those messages and believe that is what intimacy is about.
In all kinds of media, it's absolutely and if, portrayed in a way that's very unrealistic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to take it to another level, you can have that romanticized, passionate moment if you're
into
it.
If it's consensual.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, why not? mm-hmm, have the consent, mm-hmm, that's right, make sure, and have a good time. Like,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. I don't care about people's intimate contact as long as it's consensual. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, it's the lack of consent that crosses the line.
Part, like, weeks ago, we interviewed two members of the BDSM community, mm-hmm, and I often invite them over in my human sexuality class, mm-hmm, and I love how they negotiate their relationships, because mm-hmm, they, yes, do not engage the guests that we have in any type of sexual activity where there is dominance over someone without talking about it first.
Absolutely.
And they negotiate it. And in some cases, and I love this, they even have contracts, mm, written out, mm-hmm, of this is what is acceptable, this is what's not acceptable.
Right.
And then once that's all laid out, you know, and they continuously negotiate as it relates, but once they, you know, then they can enter with a little bit more confidence, more freedom, mm-hmm, into that relationship.
Absolutely.
I like that, yeah.
Absolutely. And really, all relationships should have that to some extent. They don't necessarily need to have a written contract in all relationships. And I understand that students are doing what's called hooking up, and so the extent of that relationship is only to the extent of that, right, intimate interaction,
one,
and that's
stand
it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's okay as long as it's consensual, right? But the issue comes in when people are not talking at all about what's okay, what's not okay, mm-hmm, right? And then how can you have conversations even about the use of protection, right, in intimate contact if you're just going straight into action without any conversation at all? Mm. You know, it's a scary place to be, I think, mm-hmm, for a lot of young folks. That's kind of where that comes in. The education piece is absolutely critical, right? As we continue to educate our community about what types of behaviors are not okay, what's not acceptable behavior, then reports are starting to go up, which is in theory a very good thing, right? Mm-hmm. Because these incidents are not happening any more than they always have. Mm-hmm. It's just people are now starting to realize, like, oh, that thing that happened, you know, 2 weeks ago or last month or last weekend, that was not okay. I've had reports come in as much as 2 years later, and it's, you know, from a student who's been in one of my classes that comes to me afterward and says, yeah, I learned in your class that this thing that happened to me 2 years ago was not okay, and I should have reported it, and I'm ready to talk to somebody now.
And that happens quite often when you educate others, and when we have the conversations. It's almost as a result of empowerment as, mm-hmm, well. When you piece together education and awareness and raise the awareness about a certain issue or behavior and what that means, you automatically get something that goes off in your mind and says, mm-hmm, wait a second, this behavior I experienced, I don't know, a month, 2 years ago, wasn't okay.
And it fits into the definition and the discussion that we're talking about,
right,
here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they're literally going, oh, that was a thing. That was a thing, yeah, I should have talked to somebody about.
It's almost, you know, it's almost like I'm thinking of my son. He's eventually going to have that good touch, bad touch conversation when he gets into elementary school, mm-hmm, or with teachers and such. And it's almost like that's reoccurring here. It needs to happen again for just sort of different levels and types of abuse, harassment, and assault for people,
yes,
to have that connection.
Exactly. But it's different. It's a different, yeah, phase, mm-hmm, because we're, you know, that conversation, because my daughter had that conversation, good touch, bad touch, but she is highly vulnerable as a child,
yeah,
for inappropriate touching with adults. But now, when she's older, that is good. We're going to revisit that conversation, mm-hmm, but it's going to be that now it's with a different population.
Yeah.
You know, it's, mm-hmm, now the dating, you know, whoever I'm with, you know, romantic intimacy. I mean,
yeah,
this is so important. I'm so glad that, yeah, we have this office and that you are doing this type of work.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, well, a lot of people think, when it comes to the education piece, a lot of people think this is obvious and this is common sense, and therefore we don't need to be talking about it. That's a really disempowering kind of attitude. You know, we absolutely need to be talking about this because, number one, it absolutely empowers people. Number two, this is so not common, mm-hmm, sense.
Yeah.
You know, this is not common
sense. It's complicated.
Yes, this is very complicated. Intimate relationships are complicated even without the intimacy factor, mm-hmm, right? But you start to add that into it and it gets very complicated.
Well, when you look at the numbers of one in, I know.
Yeah, let's talk about statistics,
yeah,
about people who, in the United States, college age people who experience assault, harassment.
Yeah.
Well, I can speak on some of those, and I'm sure Rihanna has a lot more, but I think one thing is, one of the most obvious ones that I've seen is the 1 in 3 women and that are experienced some sort of abuse in their lifetime or mm-hmm. type mm-hmm. of assault. And this can be, this can range from physical, sexual, emotional, or verbal type of abuse.
And that's then, not reported abuse. That's just one in three women.
That's what's reported.
Reported. Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Keeping in mind that this issue, as Oriana was mentioning earlier, is a seriously underreported issue.
Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of parents out there that don't even want to have the good touch, bad touch conversation.
Right.
Much less even there's a lot of people growing up that don't want to talk about healthy sexuality at all.
Yes.
So imagine if you're don't, if you're not even comfortable about talking about discussing healthy sexuality growing up or with your family or friends, how much comfortable will you be now that you've been a victim or a survivor
mm-hmm. that's right.
of mm-hmm. assault or abuse? Mm-hmm. It sets up a really strong barrier. And those numbers are, I mean, those are scary. That's
yeah,
one
they
in
are.
Three.
It is. It's very scary for, you know, especially having a daughter. But what's interesting is that the process of somebody actually reporting is very humiliating. I can imagine it's very humiliating for someone.
Traditionally, law enforcement has had a terrible record with handling sexual abuse, sexual assault, domestic and dating violence.
Then that person gets on the defensive. It's like, well, what did you do? You know. So I can imagine a lot of people mm-hmm. deciding, I am not going to say anything. I'm just going to go and try to forget about this experience mm-hmm. because they don't want to be re-traumatized mm-hmm. by the experience with all these questions and these pointings and what did you do? And it's just, it's a really bad situation.
I mean, it's called victim blaming, and it's part mm-hmm. of the rape culture society in which we live and operate every day. You know, it's the water we swim in to the extent that sometimes we don't even realize that something we see or hear constitutes victim blaming or shaming. And so if that's the way that the people around you, that you have typically heard them talk or that you know that they feel, how could you possibly ever feel safe to disclose, you know, if that's your family talks like that or your friends mm-hmm. talk like that?
Mm-hmm. And the culture sets you up to have to like sexual encounters as well. And for these things to be okay, or in a context of a relationship, there's a lot of male dominance, or there's a kind of a patriarchy concept of, well, you know, if you're in a relationship, you're married, you got to make it work as well, right? So there's the shame that's associated with it. There's the victim blaming that takes mm-hmm. place. And there's also just the standards in society.
The expectations.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and unhealthy masculinity, and a lot of examples of that we see very freely in the media.
And it affects the men. I mean, we talked about the women being one in three, but...
Yeah, what about men?
When you discuss the statistics that say...
Men is like one in 16 on college campuses.
On college campuses.
On college campuses. So in their lifetime, even greater. Women is about one in five in college campuses. About 20% of all students will already have experienced some form of sexual violence before they even get to college, right? So we're talking about child molestation and child abuse and things like that in those cases.
And children, boys that experience some sort of abuse growing up are twice as likely to become aggressors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're now at a higher risk of perpetuating this behavior. And if this goes unchecked, which often it does, by the time they get to college campuses, this is already a normal thing for them, or they've stuffed it deep inside where they mm-hmm. have never talked about it because there's this big shame associated with this, especially when we talk about men being strong and mm-hmm. being able to handle anything that comes your way, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to talk about it as a man, and you're just going to put it aside and you're going to continue, you know, the lifestyle, right? And that sets you up for a lot of risk.
In abusive relationships and everything.
Yeah, I can see with men just... there's another layer of shame is that, there oh my is. Gosh, here I am, you mm-hmm. know, I'm supposed to be able to take care of myself. And, you know, what does this mean about my own masculinity? And also in the gay community, and I do have to mention this, but there's, you know, a lot of sexual abuse that happens there. And there is even another layer of mm-hmm. shame. And that is, well, it, you know, mm-hmm. if I report this, if I say anything, then people will know that I'm gay, you know, and I don't want that to happen. So it becomes very complicated.
Right. Yeah. Imagine a survivor who has been sexually abused and isn't out that they're gay. And, mm-hmm. and that in and of itself, the fear of being outed or the threat of outing someone is often used as a form of control and manipulation in relationships within the community. And I also want to mention, because I feel like I have to mention, is members of the trans community.
Mm-hmm.
members of the trans community experience violence, particularly women of color in the trans community are experiencing violence at rates higher than almost any other community out there. And gay men as well are experiencing extraordinarily high rates of violence against them, relationship violence and all kinds of violence. And I want to also mention that a lot of this violence intersects, right? Mm-hmm. So in many cases of like dating violence or domestic violence, there is also stalking. There's also sexual assault, right? There's also sexual coercion and exploitation or the threat of exploiting a person, right? I have these now sexually explicit photos of you and I'm controlling and manipulating a person by consistently threatening them to out those photos to their friends or family or employer or whomever. So there's a lot of intersections there.
Mm. I wanted to you mentioned the college statistics a bit ago, and I'm wondering in your perspective, Rollins College being a smaller campus and a more intimate setting, do you believe that smaller colleges affect or impact reporting or sort of?
I do. Yeah. I do. And I believe that, and that was kind of my theory anyway, but when we started doing campus climate surveys, then I realized that theory was accurate in that and in a smaller campus like Rollins, students, they generally know, you know, one another, even if they don't know, you don't, quote, know that person, you know of that person or something about them, who they are, the social circle that they're in. And so that is actually, to some extent, detrimental to reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if, you know, I don't necessarily know you, like in some ways, our social circles can be very easily connected, right? And so students in some cases are really, really worried about reporting or about coming forward and telling anybody, right? Even a confidential source, like a mental health counselor, just because they fear that their story is going to get out somehow and that their friends within these social circles are going to find out, right? Or this sorority is always kind of attached to social events with this fraternity. And so therefore, right, like they feel like there's a conflict there that they can't report because it'll cause a rift between the two organizations. And again, some of them are really operating in environments, in social environments where the norm is that people talk in a victim blaming, shaming mm-hmm. kind of way, or in a hyper masculine way that isn't that makes them aware that they're not safe to disclose to folks in that group or to seek support from that group. And so I think that lowers our rates of reporting. Our reporting rate went from 11% of students who are, pardon, that's not reporting, that's actually numbers of students who have experienced sexual violence. So we had 11% the first time that we conducted the survey with about a 32% response rate. 11% said that they had experienced some form of sexual violence on campus in the past academic year. And that was conducted in 2015. And then in 2016, that number went from 11% to 6% who said that they had experienced it. So that on the surface, that's a good thing that the number went down, right? But for me, I don't really ever accept numbers like that at their face value. It causes me to want to dig a little bit deeper, ask a few more questions. You know, what changed? Was it the same kinds of students taking the survey, or was it a different, completely different type of student? You know, because we do have students who reside on campus and students who don't. And I imagine if we look at those populations separately, right, that those numbers would be different anyway, just by default in the nature of those populations. So, lots of interesting data to look at.
Yeah. I mean, to go from 11 to 6 is pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
And staying on the sort of the college side of things, where colleges are not atypical with alcohol and substance use and all that.
Right.
So I imagine that's, as you mentioned before, is kind of an influence in a lot of these assaults or some of these assaults.
Mm-hmm.
Are the reports that you get or from the climate survey, is there a higher percentage of alcohol and other substances being involved?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The vast majority of these instances, particularly of sexual assault, include the use of alcohol, either by both parties or the use of alcohol by a responding party to either incapacitate or otherwise create a vulnerability mm-hmm. in a reporter, in a survivor. Yeah.
And I think something that for our listeners to discuss here is that alcohol doesn't cause any sort of abuse. Alcohol does not cause any type of sexual assault.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We're not saying that if you go out and have a drink, somebody's going to get assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think at the end of this all this conversation, we need to remember that it all ultimately boils down to a choice that an aggressor makes. Right. Mm-hmm. Like we don't want to blame the victim or the survivor, but mm-hmm. we also want to think about who's making what choice.
Right.
To engage or initiate a certain type of behavior, you ultimately have that power to make the choices that you want, right? And so if there's a situation where everyone's drinking, you're still making the choice not to drink, but you're still making the choice to engage in a certain type of behavior.
Right. It lowers inhibition. It doesn't take over your mind. You
exactly.
know?
You're still making choices when you're under the influence. You're still making choices. And that, quite frankly, speaks to someone's character.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good point.
Well, it's like driving intoxicated, right? I mean, if nobody would say, a person shouldn't be held accountable for driving intoxicated and causing an accident. But all of a sudden, you know, people really question whether or not somebody should be held accountable because they were intoxicated while they perpetrated sexual assault mm-hmm. or a sexual contact with somebody without consent. So it's just really interesting the way our society looks at these things in very, very different and very, a very backwards kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your house was burglarized, nobody would say, you know, why weren't you home at that time? You know, why did you have nice things? Why did you, not turn the lights on at night?
Why did you leave your door open?
Yeah, why was your
somebody broke
why
your
was
house?
The door unlocked? Right. People wouldn't ask you questions like that. They would just really be very sorry that your house was burglarized.
That's right. Yeah. They wouldn't interrogate you, for that.
Yeah.
There would actually be more of sympathy, empathy for your experience.
They would be seeking the person responsible
mm-hmm.
For perpetrating the act. And that's the same way that we should treat these issues, right?
Yeah.
We should be seeking to hold responsible the people who are engaging in these behaviors by volition of their own choices.
Yes.
So what would you suggest for, we'll start here. What would you suggest for someone who is a victim or realizes they're a victim in terms of sort of finding support on campus? What are their mm-hmm. different sort of roads they can take?
Yeah, on campus, my best suggestions are if they want to talk with somebody with 100% complete confidentiality, talk to a mental health counselor at CAPS, a medical professional at CAPS, or at the Wellness Center, or the Dean of Religious Life, Reverend Katrina Jenkins. So they have full confidentiality there. They can also call the hotline for the Victim Service Center of Central Florida, or Harbor House of Central Florida if they're in a dating or domestic violence situation.
Do you have that number?
I got a 407-500-4325, and that's the Victim Service Center hotline as an off-campus resource.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And then the Dating Abuse Helpline is 866-331-9474. And these numbers are 24 hours a day, 365. So those are great resources. On campus, if for a person who wants complete confidentiality, isn't ready to report anything formal, they can absolutely come to me as well. Maybe they already know. I don't want to go to a counselor I just want to go straight to the office of Title IX. I make myself very visible on campus with students on purpose because I want them to know that I'm a real person and that they can trust me and that they see me around and things like that. So they can come directly to me as well. Or they can talk to a friend, right? A faculty member, whomever, if they talk to a professor or another staff or employee of the college, I want them to know that that person's mandated to report. So they're going to come and talk to me anyway. But if that's the only person that a student is willing to disclose to is their English professor because they know him or her really mm-hmm. well and they like that person, then please do, by all means, right? Let it be that person.
How can someone at the Rollins campus find you?
My office is located in the Cornell Campus Center, suite number 103 within the Office of Student Care. So if you actually walk into Dave's Boathouse Restaurant, my office is on that level. Or I can be reached by phone at 407-691-1773. Or I can reach by email, which is title9@rollins.edu. That'll come straight over to me as well. And I also have a website, which is title9rollins.edu/title9.
And what would you suggest for students who want to help and support their friends who are victims?
Yeah, so important, because for the vast majority of people are not going to be victimized or survivors of violence. The vast majority of people are going to be bystanders. They're going to be people who are put in a position to do something, to help someone. So one of the best things that you can do if a friend comes to you to disclose information about a sexual trauma, number one, is understand and be incredibly grateful, because that means that they trust you immensely if they're coming to you to tell you this information.
And believe them.
Yes. Number two, absolutely believe them no matter what it is that they say. Believe their story. Don't question or doubt their story about whatever it is. Their story is their story. They may or may not recall every single detail, and not recalling every detail doesn't mean they're lying. So believe them. Listen to what they have to say, with empathy, in a respectful way, in a caring way. Don't give advice, I would say. Don't give advice. Don't tell them it's going to be okay, because you don't know that, and we have this incredibly strong desire to just tell people it's going to be okay, don't worry. I think that particular phrase in particular can be very triggering for people who are in a traumatic state of events. So it's not necessary to tell them it's going to be okay, but do the legwork to do some research, know what the resources are, or just go to the Title IX website and find out what they are. Do the legwork with or for that person and bring them the phone number to the Title IX office, to the Wellness Center. Go with them to the Wellness Center. Call the Wellness Center on their behalf and make an appointment with them. When you're in crisis like that, something that might seem as simple as picking up a phone and dialing a few numbers is actually extremely hard and scary. And in talking to that person, you don't know who's going to answer. What are they going to say? Right. In that person's mind, everything is so it's so big in that moment. Do those things with them and for them, and guide them and get them there.
And
get
also
them to help.
Remember that the first time that you hear about this may not be the first time that it's happened. And that statistically speaking, it takes about seven to nine times for someone to leave a toxic or abusive, unhealthy relationship.
Yes.
So, and you're talking 7 to 9 times in the course of a year or 10 years or a couple months. So know that the first time that they disclose may not be the first time it's happened. And it may not be the time that they're ready to actually go talk to someone about it either. Maybe they just, they're ready to talk to you. And so when you believe them, you set up that space for them to be able to continue coming back to you. And that's your cue to just empower, let them know you're there for them. Let them know there's resources whenever they're ready, that you got their back and you're willing to walk through that step, through that process with them.
The only time that I would be a little bit more forceful about, care and support as a friend is when a person clearly needs medical attention, right? If a person has been abused to the extent that they need medical attention, right, they're injured in some way, you want to help them to understand that they need medical attention sooner rather than later. And then particularly when we're talking about cases of rape and sexual assault that include penetration, a person has 5 days to get what they call a sexual assault nurse examiner's exam. It's called a SANE exam. Back in the day, it used to be called a rape kit. It's 120 hours or 5 days after the event. So there's a timeline on that. So that's the only reason I mentioned being a little bit more forceful about doing that. And then the person should maybe talking to them about getting tested for STDs, STIs at that point in time, or as quickly as possible after that incident, is really important as well. But barring that situation where a person is really, where you see as a friend that person is in need of immediate medical attention, those are the other things that you should be doing as well, as letting them, take action at their pace.
And the friend, I imagine, being the friend they've always been, which is in a person who's living in crisis and turmoil, you're that safe person, you're that familiar thing, you're that predictable thing, and that's probably why they're going to you.
Yes, right. Absolutely. Some people will get really weird, like, oh, I don't know, you know, this person's going through trauma. Do I call them? Do I not call them? Do I check in? Do I not check in? Yes, check in.
Mm-hmm.
Call. Keep doing, you know, if you would have called every day before, call. Keep calling every day. If you would have called every, you know, 2 days before or 5 days, call a little bit more frequently this time.
They're probably hoping that someone does reach out. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Trust me, they may not say that they need the help or would like someone to reach out to them. Because, again, some of the things we've already discussed, the shame or the not fully understanding what took place and what happened, but still needing for someone to be there for
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm. And I want us to, and thank you so much for both coming in today.
Thanks.
For a third time.
Yeah.
And
being with us.
Good.
Yeah. And April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so mm-hmm. I wanted to hear about some of the things that are going on here at Rollins okay. College.
Well, we have a mixture of things, community as well as things at the campus. I know that at the beginning of the month, we had our rally against violence on the 4th, and we had a great turnout. A lot of community partners showed up, mm-hmm. Planned Parenthood,
Yeah, we always
Center.
Kick off Sexual Assault Awareness Month with the Rollins Rally Against Violence, which is an awesome community event. So we're looking forward to doing that again.
Mm-hmm.
This Friday, we're going to have Harbor House come out again. We're going to be in Bush Room 201. We're going to be doing a talk on what prevention looks like in intimate partner violence relationships. But for the rest of the month, Harbor House of Central Florida on the 22nd of mm-hmm. April, they're going to do a Pause for Peace walk. So if you got your pet or, you know, you want to go out and take a walk for a good cause with mm-hmm. your pet, you can go out there to Blue Jacket Park at 8 a.m. And there'll be a ton of people with great dogs and great pets and, you know, just a great place to have mm-hmm. good conversations. Also, the 26th of April is Denim Day. So just wear some jeans on that day. And Denim Day is particularly dedicated to as a protest responding to the Italian Supreme Court's overruling of a rape conviction in the 90s, where someone was found, I guess, acquitted of charges because the court was saying, well, you know, you had jeans on when you were assaulted, and jeans are kind of hard to take off. So, you know, the aggressor must have had help from the victim
mm-hmm.
To take those pants off for the penetration to happen. Mm-hmm. So the aggressor was acquitted because of that idea, right? So on the 26th, you can wear jeans to stand mm-hmm. in solidarity with that cause. And also on the 28th of April, there is a Sexual Assault Awareness Month conference. And that's going to be taking place in Valencia College, the one in Osceola. And it's a free conference, goes on from 8 to 5. If you really want to get immersed in, I guess, some of the resources and things that you can do to be an active bystander or just a resource in your particular community, you should definitely attend this conference on the 28th. And yeah, that's some of the stuff that's going on for the rest of the month. Yeah.
Great. Some wonderful events. And I imagine these are happening every year.
Yes.
Yes.
And there are other educational opportunities and programs that are continuing throughout the academic year.
Definitely.
As well here at Rollins.
Definitely. Yes. A lot of awareness weeks and events that, you know, we celebrate Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We do have a It's On Us Week of Action.
Consent Week.
Consent mm-hmm. Week as well, where we talk mm-hmm. about consent. We give out consent condoms. I mean, a lot of stuff that's happening throughout the year for just all of us to have the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All very important messages. And thank you so much for coming today. The Title IX office, as I mentioned before, is just such a wonderful resource for all of our students and faculty and staff. And the offer, the support, as well as the education and really helping to shape these minds and behaviors of maturing young adults is such an important piece, and we're very fortunate that you are the people that are doing that.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you both so much for having us.
Yeah, definitely.
And we were Freudian Clips on WPRK 91.5 FM, the best in basement radio and the voice of Rollins College. Thanks so much for listening. Check out those events every year. I'm Dr. Palladino.
And I'm Dr. Sanabria.
And thanks again.
Hello again.